So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's January 18th, 2016. 17? Oh, you're right. I'm very sure. 17? 19, 20? Good. Something like that. It's the 18th. It is the 18th. Nice. You tricked me. I knew it was the 18th. Okay. Anyway. And as you probably know, last year we spent a lot of time on mindfulness, kind of finishing up with the fourth of the Buddha's four establishments or locations for or foundations of mindfulness, including an exploration of factors of awakening and investigation. And then, as I've been saying, this year I want to focus more on relationships and also, as I'll write you, so if you want to get the announcement for this, make sure you're on the email list for this sitting group. I plan to, on the fourth Wednesday of the month, do something more experiential than a typical kind of classic Dharma talk and discussion. And that'll start, I think, this month, and I'll explain all that in the thing I'll send you. Okay, so that's sort of background. And in terms of investigation, I thought it would be interesting to investigate tonight something that is at the intersection of personal self-caring as well as relatedness. And that is, so I'm going to slide into it, and it's an investigation of reassurance and relief. Two, I think, underestimated, really useful, really valuable experiences that are truly close to practice. So to get into it, I think it could be really said that Buddhism, like many of the world's religions, or you could say the essence or the foundation of clinical psychology in the West, begins with a recognition of our vulnerability. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. There is suffering. We are frail. Classes break. The body gets older. We eventually die. As a surgeon client of mine once said, all bleeding stops eventually, Rick, one way or another. Right? So we're vulnerable, we're frail, things happen to us. How do we deal with that? One major way to deal with that is to find refuge. And there's a strong emphasis in Buddhism, as in other wisdom traditions, in finding refuge of various kinds. Refuge in our favorite armchair, refuge watching the Golden State Warriors with your partner, which I hope to do later tonight, refuge in knowing that you did turn off the stove, refuge in the Dharma, the teaching, refuge in teachers, refuge in community, refuge in the fact that you're all tucked in and your roof has no leaks, and even if it's raining outside, you're dry and okay. Refuge in appreciating the fact you did get home safely without hydroplaning. So, refuge of various kinds. I want to explore the refuges with you tonight of reassurance and relief and start with a little bit of a personal story. So, last week, I don't know if you were here, and this will be very relevant if you were here last week and in the front row, after I gave my Dharma talk with lots of waving and arms moving around and conversation, and we were all done and people were leaving, Bill very kindly came over to me and whispered in my ear, "Oh, Rick, your fly's unzipped." So I went, whoa, ruh-roh, quickly whoop, zipped it up, and then tried to practice with that. What an opportunity for reassurance and relief. So I don't know if you can imagine a comparable sort of situation for yourself. It's kind of close to those dreams where we walk out of the house and halfway through our business day we realize that we're wearing our underwear from the waist down and nothing more, or something like that. So I tuned into noticing that, you know, after riding the first dart, as it were, the first little wave of chagrin and I investigated. It stirred up a similar moment when I was in high school. And I was giving a talk, and in my English class, I think, and the background here is relevant, that I was quite a shy and nerdy and very young dorky person in high school, and it happened to be Bermuda Shorts Day once a year in my high school, West Covina. And I was leaning against the desk with my hands in my pockets, leaning back, these tight Bermuda shorts, trying to be cool, and pop, the zipper popped open. Ah! You know, you can just imagine. So what I noticed in this episode, so I'm investigating in real time. Seconds are ticking by. Just a few seconds, it pulls up that earlier memory and the related embarrassment. And then it also pulls up the realization that the whole thing was just funny when I was in high school. People laughed. It was no big deal. It was actually good because I was this brainy kid. And now I had something to joke about and, you know, kind of admit I'd goofed up about, something like that. And so that was okay. It was reassuring. It was relieving. And then even here, I replayed the whole event. I realized that people had not been staring at my crotch the whole time. Probably most people hadn't noticed. We had about twice as many people here last week. It was harder to see. And it was all okay. And I also accessed the fact that you guys like me. I'm all right. You know what I mean? My fly's unzipped. Bummer. Oh, well. Nothing's hanging out. Don't worry. It was all right. You know, it was like relief. It was reassurance in real time. And the whole thing just kind of was a dozen seconds, right? But that's how relief and reassurance often lands, right? We're alarmed about something, ruh-roh, and then, or maybe there's a background of alarm, and then comes in some useful information and some soothing. Bill could not have been kinder or mellow, you know, kind of telling me it was really okay. And then we can investigate the relief that can come in as we receive the reassurance. It wasn't so bad. The body's calming. There is forgiveness. There is a safety net. There is repair. There is, as the great British psychiatrist Daniel Winnicott, a child psychiatrist, talked about, the primal importance of experiencing going on being, which is so critically important for young children as well as for everyone, to really feel like you're going on being and to offer that kind of reassurance to others. One thing that I've focused on a lot myself when I've started reflecting lately on the kind of down-to-earth, homespun, modest, humble benefits of reassurance. It's so down-to-earth. We're assuring people and reassuring others and ourselves. Assurance, in other words, things are sure, they are secure, they are reliable, they are trustable, there is safety. That most primal need of all, you know, speaking to the evolution of the brain, the inner lizard, if you will, inside us all, who needs lots of petting, lots of soothing, lots of reassurance that one is safe. So I've actually started looking more at being reassuring with others. Not in ways that are condescending or deny real threats. I'm very glad Sundara pointed out that it is risky out there. Part of what's reassuring, in a sense, is to know that you know. In other words, that you're driving down the road with your eyes open. That's reassuring. It's reassuring to have your headlights on, so that you know you can see ahead of you. You know, it's reassuring to be grounded in reality. I have had two melanomas pulled out of my face in the last 6 years, I think. And I go see my dermatologist twice as often as is recommended. I see her four times a year, and always a little nervous in the waiting room, what's going to happen. And then when I leave, it's reassuring. Okay. And because I'm going twice as often, I'm reassured that if she misses one, I'll have a safety net. You know, I'll have a second parachute, as it were, because I'll see her again in just 3 months. Okay. So flip it around. I will lately really look into being reassuring with other people. Often it's nonverbal. We touch them. We're okay with what's going on. We give them information they need. We give them the reassurance that we've received them. We hear them. We may not agree with them, but at least we've heard them. We understand them. The reassurance of not being intimidating or dominating or threatening or bullying ourselves really forms a reassurance. Also, if you think about the needs of the other person, so think of an important relationship, perhaps your partner, a child, even an adult child, maybe a coworker, maybe a client. What could be some of the top priority needs or goals or wants running in the mind of that person? And maybe, particularly if they're not your need, or they're not so important to you personally, but they're really important to that person. How can you deliver almost proactively or preemptively reassurance to that person about their need? For example, to, summarize and simplify a lot of material that sometimes, for various reasons, tracks to gender, but not necessarily. Some people have a high need for autonomy, and they're very prickly about anything that feels like domination or control coming at them. Other people, they want autonomy, but for them, it's more kind of an immediate top of the list need for intimacy, connectedness, that we're together, right? Or maybe some people really need to maintain an optimal distance from others, while other people really need to kind of pull for what are called narcissistic supplies, feeling that you're seen, you're valued, you're cherished, you're appreciated, you're esteemed, okay? One way we can reassure others is to think a little bit about, what's their top priority? What's top of the stack? What's their imperative? In a situation or in an interaction or in a long-term relationship, such that if that top priority need is challenged, everything else goes out the window. Think about adolescents who have a super high priority on autonomy, and they will give everything up to protect that top priority. On the other hand, think about parents who have a need for that their kids safe, right? So how can parents, let's say, honor the adolescent's need for autonomy and reassure that they support that in exchange for the adolescent reassuring the parent about the parent's need that their kid is safe? See? So it's actually quite useful in relationships to have some reflection about what is the top priority of the other person and how can I deliver that reassurance. In a work environment, maybe the other person needs to know that you're committed to keeping your agreements at work, that they really matter to you. You pay attention to them, you're focused on them. So you deliver that, and then they give you more room to breathe, right? Maybe your wife needs to really, really know that you love her, so you keep delivering that, and then she becomes more relaxed about you working late at night to finish writing something about American politics that's gonna go out tomorrow morning. Right? Okay. So moving toward kind of a wrap here and then seeing what you make of all this, I want to offer four concrete suggestions about reassurance and relief, four opportunities for reassurance and relief. The first is the bad news that didn't happen. It's funny, we habituate to bad news that doesn't happen because there's so much of it. We don't notice it anymore, right? I don't want to freak you out, okay? But think of all the cars you drive by that do not crash into you. Now my wife says, oh, don't say that. That'll make them hit you. No, really. Just imagine. I drove here from Terra Linda. I probably passed several hundred at least. I have no idea of cars. Not one of them smacked into me. I drove down Lincoln. Nobody crossed the line. I was on the freeway. Nothing bad happened. Just think about that. But do we notice it? Think about all the people who, we're aggressive primates. Think about all the people you walk by who don't slug you. Amazing! Think about that. Think about all the chairs you sit on that don't break beneath you, right? Think of all the electrical lights that you turn on that don't shock you. It's kind of weird to say it, but think of all the bad news that doesn't happen. Okay. That's one really, really neat refuge. Second refuge or reassurance is noticing things that are working, that you're getting done. little goals accomplished, little tasks completed, interactions with another person that went fine, the repairs that were made in around some misunderstanding maybe with another person or some way they didn't feel fully understood or were miffed at, you know, some friction between the two of you. It actually got done. Our dishwasher rack earlier today was wonky, and we figured out how to make it slide in and out properly. It was like a two-minute moment, but it was reassuring, you know? And in our family, my wife's actually the repair person. I'm kind of the clueless ivory tower person. But on this one, I was able to figure out that dishwasher, and I was proud of that fact. Reassurance, right? Okay. Third form of reassurance that's, and there are more than these four, but I'm just kind of calling them out. So first being, you know, bad things that didn't happen. Second, things you get done along the way. Third, the reassurance of just other people who have goodwill for you. They give you the benefit of the doubt. They, you know, they don't hear every word you say, but they're mostly attentive. There's a friendliness, a warmth from them, often a kind of a basic goodwill, camaraderie, good humor toward you, let alone real love, I mean, real support, real caring, real coming through for you, real esteem for you. They have high standards and you meet them, things like that. So that, again, is another opportunity. The reassurance even of just being in community with people often you don't know well, if at all, and yet we're all kind of together here. That's reassuring. And in the reassurance, we can really feel relief. We can feel reassurance spreading inside, calming that soft, furry animal we all are that's always kind of vulnerable, a little freaked out. Oof. Other people. And then the fourth opportunity for reassurance and relief is the recognition of being basically a good person. Whoa. Recognize your own intentions, good intentions, wise intentions, commitment to justice, a willingness to know where you stand personally, which is what I was writing about today and have been for several days. Knowing where you stand personally, standing up for what you recognize and value, and standing with others with regard to what you recognize and what you value. And that you're the kind of person who does that. You're the kind of person who admits error. You might be a little late to it or a little grumbly about it, but you basically cop to it. Knowing that you're the kind of person who is engaged in personal practice. You're practicing for yourself in your own path, but you're also practicing for others. I've become a lot better father and hopefully a better husband over the years of my own practice. Hopefully I, you know, as you, have been able to offer something to others in widening ripples, widening circles through our own practice. You're a kind of person who does that. You are that kind of person. That too is reassuring, isn't it? And there can be kind of a relief that goes with that. Whoa, you know, I'm not so bad after all, right? And in fact, actually, maybe I'm basically good. Wow, that's a relief. And finishing then, there can be an investigation of all this. We're investigating. We're keeping our eyes open. We're inquiring. We're looking. There's kind of an active process of finding things that are reassuring, of investigating the experience of relief, what that feels like in general. And in this investigation, we enable reassurance and relief to sink into us as we sink into these experiences. And in the process of resting in experiences of reassurance and relief, we of course hardwire them increasingly. We learn reassurance. We learn relief increasingly woven into the fabric of our own nervous system. Good news. That's a relief. All right. Any questions or comments, discussion? And I'll end close to 8:30. Good. Great.
Would you mind saying that last little part again, how it works when we do this, we hardwire?
Yeah. Sure. Well, basically, we're designed to learn from our experiences. whether it's a little baby learning to, you know, kind of focus on nursing, or a child learning to, you know, ride a bicycle, or an adult learning how to navigate a tricky conversation, or learning about our own experience, learning about our own thoughts and feelings and reactions and impulses, and learning how to manage our own psyche, our own mind, more effectively. All that's learning. So we want to grow. So let's say we want to grow in the internalization of a sense of refuge, because we are vulnerable, we are frail. We want to develop more of a sense of calm strength inside. And we recognize that a factor of that sense of calm strength is an internalization of repeated experiences of reassurance and relief. We literally take in the good. We want to take it into ourselves. So how do you grow the good inside yourself? It's a very straightforward two-step process. And it's the universal process of healing, learning, development, growth. We have the experience, relief or reassurance. But if we want it to have more than passing value, just through the mind like water through a sieve, we have to stay with it long enough for it to get encoded and consolidated in the brain. So it's a two-step process of learning. We have to have the experience. You've got to get the song going. Reassurance, relief, the body sensations of that, the idea of it, what have you. And then we need to turn on the recorder to create a lasting change of neural structure or function. Otherwise, by definition, there's no development. It was momentarily pleasant or useful, but it was gone. That's the dirty little secret of psychotherapy, coaching, raising kids, mindfulness training. Most of the experiences that most people have no enduring value. So the question is, how can we harvest them better? How can we steepen our own personal growth curve as we go through life? And that gets to the simplicity, really, of enjoying the experience 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row, opening to it, in the classic saying, neurons that fire together, wire together, just keeping them firing longer, in a more embodied way, more intensively, seeing how it's personally relevant, tracking rewards, which release dopamine and norepinephrine, which flag experiences for protection in the processes of consolidation. All of those things, in a very natural way, can be practiced in the flow of life to really, really, really cultivate the wholesome in ourselves for both well-being and for dealing with hard things. The harder a person's life, the more it sucks, the more important it is to look for the good and take it in. And no one, only you can do that, and no one can stop you from doing it. So we're both responsible and liberated. Yeah, I'll say it again. So what happens when there's a mismatch? You know, say an adult child who wants lots of autonomy, and let's say it's the parent of that adult child who wants intimacy with the adult child and with the grandchild or children, right? Really a very familiar and common, you know, very real and poignant situation. And we've got a 29-year-old and a 26-year-old, no grandchildren yet. What are they thinking? They got to get to it, but they're not yet to it. So anyway, what to do? So I have a couple offerings about it. One is just normalizing the differences. Oftentimes, we make an ideology out of our own personality. You know, I'm in the self-help space, and very often people make their own personal temperament the rule for everyone. But the truth is, there's diversity. People are really different, both in terms of constitution and then conditioning or socialization or acculturation going through life, right? People really, really kind of vary. And so rather than addressing these sort of issues as right or wrong or as rules, like there's something wrong with you, you don't want more intimacy. There's something wrong with you that you don't respect more autonomy. Mm-hmm. Getting past that, just normalizing it. And then kind of thinking of it as a practical issue. That's one. Second, look for and hope for that there's some kind of overlap between your range and their range. Like maybe your range is, I'll do it like this, like this is autonomy, or I'll do autonomy first, autonomy here. You'd prefer to have this much autonomy, but you could live with this much in some relationship or situation. Over here is intimacy. You'd prefer to have this much intimacy, but you can live with this much. Question is there an overlap, right? Is their low end, can your high end of the range match their low end of the range? I probably did it the other way around, but you know what I mean. All right, so, and then you kind of negotiate it on practical terms. And I've done that with a lot. You know, I tend to load pretty high on autonomy, so I've had to negotiate this with other people. But if people just sort of name it and you kind of sort it out at a practical level, you can do it. Right. Then the last thing I'll say is, especially with adult children, to give them the reassurance that you won't be annoying. You know, I think about how often my parents annoyed me and how I restricted my relationship with them as a result. Punish them sometimes to just leave me alone or to teach them a lesson. And, you know, the truth is that we tend to need our, how can I put it? Our kids are often more important to us than we are to them. Kind of name it. And whatever should be true, that is what's true very often. And so if we are annoying or intrusive or invasive at all, they will expect that to happen next time. And due to the brain's negativity bias, that experience gets overlearned. You know, it's kind of like if you ever touch something and it burns you, you just don't ever touch it again. And so what I've done myself in situations is I recognize this and I just resolve to myself, I'm going to go to zero on what's annoying for them. That doesn't mean walking on eggshells and you have to sort out, you know, what that actually looks like on a practical thing. But very often it's possible to just stop being annoying to them. Doesn't mean that you're a bad. You're probably not annoying to a different person. And I won't even get into how they're annoying you. But at least in terms of wooing nature, wooing the other person, thinking really through, I'm going to zero out any cause for complaint. Even if they, based on familiar scripts or patterns of relatedness, kind of draw you back in or try to draw you back in to that role that's annoying, but it's a familiar role, right? So, and I've really enjoyed that, having interaction after interaction after interaction in which I knew I had done nothing that was problematic. Not one syllable, not one facial expression, not one word. And, you know, I had to be pretty mindful to do that, but with practice, I got better and better at it. So, yeah. Yeah, well, that's a deeper thing. I'm not yet a grandparent, so I can't speak to it directly, but, and I'm a guy, and for whatever difference that makes, you know, acknowledging differences. I guess what I would say, a couple things. One is to feel the longing, and I would call it longing rather than craving. It's natural. It's such a longing. And it's bittersweet, isn't it? It's sweet, but it's bitter because it's not fulfilled. And to just really experience it and explore it, investigate it as an experience. What's this like? You know, what's it feel like in the body? What's it feel like in around my heart? You could apply this to longing for love in other ways, or maybe longing for other social supplies, including approval or admiration or success, or, you know. You could apply it to sexuality, to anything physical, affectionate, or sensual, just the longing. You explore it as an experience. And in the process of being with it, often it changes and flows, and it passes. And then maybe it comes again, and then you explore it again. So just that, that's fundamental mindfulness, fundamental investigation. You're investigating the experience. And what can happen, and you're a long-time practitioner, you know this, you start recognizing the nature of the experience itself, and familiar themes come back again and again. You know, you start recognizing that, like any experience, it has so many parts, it comes and goes, there's no owner, there's no creator or director of it. It's fairly impersonal as a process. It's more like the longing as, let's say, a woman, a mother, and a grandmother is caused by 200 million years of mammalian evolution. You know? Like, as well as more recent primate, hominid, human evolution and culture and other factors. And it's this wave moving through you. It's less personal. And that tends to relieve you. And insight into that longing then can be transferred to other experiences as well. So they're less binding and freer. You start recognizing that the experience of longing, in the technical sense, is empty. It's foamy, fizzing, insubstantial. It's existent, but it need not bring suffering. Yeah, right? And then I think making requests, you know, to make a request and then see if you can negotiate concretely and just live with the result. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I can express this in a coherent sort of way, but I'm in a situation with an aging parent that's very perilous. And there really is no refuge or reassurance, because every time I think there is, and I take a breath and say she'll be fine, the next new thing comes and just whacks me upside the head.
Yeah.
And then I'm in, it's like no matter how I try to think about this, I keep getting knocked down and knocked down and knocked down. So now my expectation is negative. And then something good will happen and people go, see, you shouldn't have worried about it. Well, I damn well should have worried about it. It was awful. It could have killed her. Right then, it could have killed her.
Yeah.
If I hadn't been there to take the action and looked for the negative. But then she recovers, or they're, they, it's like they keep patching things. They patch it here, something else happens here. And it's endless. I mean, it's been going on for 9 or 10 days. And the stress level, it's like there's no refuge. Because even when I rest, it never stops up here. I'm only the stress. I can't be my normal self. I can't sit and read the newspaper. I can't enjoy a cup of coffee. I'm nothing but the stress.
Well, that is suffering right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I won't try to repeat it. You know, I think it was clear. You were clear. You really were, you know, and as you know, my father died about 15, and I relate to it a lot. And
and there's other family members.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's,
yeah, it's a mess.
It's a mess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a few things. So the more challenged we are over here, the more resourced we need to be over here. That's a rule. That's a law of medicine, business, physical health, relationships, and mental health, right? So dealing with a 4-alarm fire over here, let's say, it's critically important to really lock on and jettison stuff you can't afford to carry. I think about the metaphor, if you're jogging at sea level, you know, you can put a 20-pound rock in your backpack, but walking uphill through snow at 20,000 feet, hauling your mother behind you, you can't afford anything, you know, no extra burden in your backpack, including negative rumination. So, you know, The more challenged we are over here, the more important it is to lock on. Am I eating properly? Am I maintaining my personal practices? You know, am I, you know, having fun with friends? Am I finding places in my day, moments in my day, where there's a sense of calming, centering, coming home again? You know, that's really important. Am I cuddling with my partner? Am I still taking bubble baths, right? Do I just, that. So that's one really important thing. Second thing is to be reassured and take refuge in knowing I did everything I could. That's so critically important. Of the 10,000 causes, so-called, we can take care of 10 of them. So we take care of the 10 we can. I remember a friend of mine, he's a professor at Harvard Medical School, very high-end, elite academic doctor. He ran the Harvard Medical School Children's Hospital intensive care unit for a long time. So really high-risk kids, roughly half of them don't make it there. You know, super technology, Harvard, layers of capability, the best of the best of the best care in the world, okay? So I visited once with my friend Bob, and I said at the end of it, because it's heart-wrenching, all these children, these are children, including teenagers, in life and death situations, grieving families, very high-stakes medicine. And I said, wow, Bob, it must really give you reassurance and relief to know that you have all this super technology and science and layers of hyper-competent, motivated people to take care of these kids. And he said, Rick, I think the stuff we've got here affects maybe 10% of the outcome. The rest is out of our hands. Wow. And that was like, wow. He wasn't ducking responsibility. He was hardcore on the 10% that was in their circle of influence. But he recognized the limits, and he went to bed every night knowing he'd done everything he could. Even if that kid died, let's say, he knew he did everything he could. And on a lower priority scale, in many situations, with smaller stakes, we could still take refuge in the reassurance, I did what I could today. A reasonable person can only do this much. You know, the term to be licensed, I'm licensed as a psychologist or a physician, doesn't matter. What's a reasonable standard of care? Did I do what I could today, particularly in terms of the marathon of care? A reasonable standard for a sprint is different from a reasonable standard for a marathon. In the long-term care of an aging parent or dealing with many situations, you know, a standard that's reasonable for what you can do every day, day after day after day, is different. But at least you met that standard. That is reassuring. That's the second thing. Third thing I find is to, how can I put it, to be at peace in the middle of your own intensity. And I experienced a lot of intensity around the care of my father and fierceness. I was fierce. And you see me mainly in a pretty chilled out mode. And my Scottish heritage, maybe I can be pretty serious, pretty fierce. And it's not aggressive, not macho or nutty, but just really locked onto it. You know, for the 4 or 5 months of the primary piece of his care, my wife and son said, you know, they'd never seen me in this way, day after day after day. And I went, yeah, you know, I've never had my father, you know, have serious strokes and get mediocre care in some regards while dealing with a lot of craziness around it. Like, yeah, and I hope you are this fierce if I'm in this pickle someday, you know? So I was fierce. But in the center of it, it's really weird. I don't know if you've experienced this. You can be really, really intense, but in the center of it all, there's something calm and clear and still. And that's where repeated practice helps, because you become more and more able to feel tuned into a still place inside in the midst of a lot of peripheral busyness and activity. You know, your adrenaline is surging, the words are coming out of your mouth, maybe a little spit is flying, maybe your fly is open, I don't know. That's a different situation. But in the midst of all that, there's something that's super untroubled. You know, it's like being 20 feet down, 10 feet down, when the storm is passing overhead, but it's quiet 10 feet down. quiet 10 feet down. And you just try to find that place. And you, when you find it, you take it in, you stay with it, you register it, so you learn it and you know how to get back there again the next time. You record that song, as it were, so you can play it again at will. That sense of stillness and clarity. And you're just not identified. Not identified with whatever's happening. It's not me. You know, it's this body, but it's not me. I'm not claiming it. I'm not identifying with it. You know, as part of that stillness. So I'll just offer that. And then the last thing is kind of goes to what you brought up, and I'll finish on this point. No matter what they do, and no matter what limitations there are and what they give you, no one can ever stop you from having a kind heart. No one can ever stop you from doing the best you can now, in the most important minute of your life, the next minute, minute after minute after minute. No one can stop us at all. Maybe our actions are bound, but no one can stop us from doing whatever we can, whether we're dealing with an aging parent or, as Viktor Frankl wrote so eloquently, stuck in a concentration camp, you know? And if we can't make them attend to us or spend time with us or give us love we want, you know, that we do what we can, we try to influence them and we reserve our rights to have moral judgment, that's our right to know what our own values are, still, nothing, no one can stop us from resting in our own radiating goodness, our own lovingness for them. One of the breakthroughs for me and a very important person in my life some years ago was to realize that I couldn't get that person to love me, but that person couldn't stop me from loving that person. And that's where I rested, abiding as love. No one can stop you from abiding as love. And that's reassuring and a relief. Okay? How about we just sit for 1 minute and then we'll officially end. Thank you very much. It's reassuring that the bell works every time. Be well and drive safely. See you next week.